If you're trying to figure out how to navigate the tricky tightrope of parenting while you have questions, doubts, and wonderings about your spiritual journey, our podcast is for you.
It doesn't matter if your kids are smalls, middles, or bigs. We'll explore what and how we're deconstructing from churchianity, harmful belief systems, and diving deep into the ways we can work this out in parenthood.
We're also going to work through ideas for reconstructing a space for our families to thrive under new systems of love and freedom.
We can't wait to bring you some hope that you're not alone and that it's really okay, even good, to explore all the possibilities that may have felt closed off in the past.
Our podcast is going to offer you grace and space to be exactly where you are and who you are.
We're really glad you're here, and we're excited for today's episode. Listen in.
I couldn't have imagined willingly leaving a place I loved so much. I couldn't have imagined then that in order to hold on to my faith, I would have to let go of my church. Those words are from Emily P. Freeman in her new book, How to Walk into a Room.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Deconstructing Mamas podcast. We're talking with Emily Freeman today. She's a best-selling author, podcaster, spiritual director, and so much more. So, Emily, we're so excited to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Are you kidding? Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we're so excited. I told Emily beforehand that I'm a little fangirling because she has been a massive influence in my spiritual journey. So I am very excited about having you, Emily. Thank you so much.
Well, before we get into some of our deeper stuff, can you tell us a little bit about what your day looks like, what your family looks like, and then outside of some of those have-tos, what is something that makes your heart come alive?
Okay, so what do my days look like? Well, I get to work from home, which is great, but every day looks a little different. I think if I were queen for a day, I would have like all my days look exactly the same, so I knew what to expect. But then I also think like, Emily, that's not true. You probably would hate that, because I could do that if I wanted, but I don't. So yes, I have a podcast, I write, I have a Substack. So those things, I keep thinking that I'm going to be the type of person who can batch record and batch write and like be really organized in that way. And I'm still doing it like week to week. And I think I've finally, after what, 10 years now, 15 years of doing this work, I think this is how I work. I think this is my process. It's just a week to week thing. So that's kind of what it looks like-ish. So I'm married to my husband, John. We've been married for 22 years. Mm-hmm. We have twins who are 20. So they're second year college students. And then we have a son who is 17, almost 18, junior in high school. So we're like 3 seconds away from being empty nesters, which mm-hmm. is, you know, depending on the day, good or terrible. So ask me in a year and I'll let you know how I'm feeling about things. Aww. But one of the things that kind of just like, this is so dumb, the dumbest that makes my heart come alive is, so we have this dog that is almost like this summer, he'll be 14. He's an old dog. And he does not make my heart come alive. He makes my heart sink. Like, it is a love-hate relationship ever since we got this dog. How did they talk me into this? I'm still like, I'm not a dog person 14 years later. But the dog talks. The dog has a voice. And unfortunately for me and you, the dog is my voice. And so sometimes when the family is feeling down, you know, Finn will chime in and we'll have a pep talk, or Finn will share how he feels about the day or about life. And I'll tell you that, like, I kind of hate myself that this has started and that now, you know, like, I am the voice of the dog. And yet every time our dog is a part of the conversation, I have to say it kind of makes my heart sing a little bit because everybody laughs and it's a real delight.
Talk more about this. Like, does the dog have like a character voice? Like,
well, I mean, maybe he might have one.
Oh, yes. Oh, I love that.
Sounds a little cartoony, but the dog never speaks to me. Like, that we don't acknowledge one another's presence. It's like that's breaking the fourth wall or whatever. Like, we can't, that's not a thing. So this is the only place where I have admitted that I actually am the voice of the dog. Like, no one else knows.
Okay. Okay.
That's kept secret.
So don't let your family listen to this
podcast.
Don't
tell my family. Right.
Yep. Okay. Got it.
I love that because I am not a dog person either. And we've had a couple dogs, and I liked our dogs, but I don't really care about your dog. So when I'm out walking our dog, and other people are like, "Oh, can I say hi to your dog? What breed is that?" I'm like, "Well, you can say hi you want, but I'm not going to really ask about your dog."
I definitely feel like I was a dog person. Our dog is 11, so he's getting old. He's been around like probably as almost as long as my husband and I have known each other or been together. And he was my baby until I had babies. And then I was like, I cannot take care of another thing. Let
No,
yourself
no.
out. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and so now he has become more, I mean, deep down I love him, but he's become more of an annoyance because I'm like, sorry, I've got these two other kids that like still can't do things for themselves.
Like, wash a dish, dog. I mean, take out the
Yes, do
trash.
something.
Be
Yes.
useful.
I know the toddlers who never grow up. That's what I say.
Oh my gosh, it's so true.
Perpetually three.
Oh, how exhausting to think about that.
All right, we're going to start our podcast, but we can talk about this all day. I would be thrilled. All right. If you had to, Emily, describe your spiritual background in one word or one phrase, what would it be and why?
Well, the first phrase, I try to go with first thoughts. Natalie Goldberg taught me that in writing, but don't edit out your first thoughts. And I think the first thing that comes to mind when you ask that question is friend of Jesus. And I grew up in a Southern Baptist tradition, a little Southern Baptist church in the middle of a cornfield in Columbus, Indiana. And there's a lot about that that I've had to re-examine over the years about that place of upbringing. But one thing that has remained, I think, throughout since I was very small all the way till now is a friendship with Jesus. And so that's probably the simplest way I can think of to describe my faith journey.
So in that, even when you were a little, even in maybe say a more rigid or traditional denomination or faith system, that was the main thing that came across to you, or that was the main thing you took away from it growing up?
I don't know if it was the main thing, but I think it's the simplest thing. And so, I mean, I remember being first grade, sitting with my friend Tara on the playground at school and telling her all about my friend Jesus. Now, what I can also tell you is that it did not occur to me that maybe she already was friends with Jesus. Maybe she expressed that differently. Maybe she didn't care at all. Like, that was not part of my first grade theology or theological perspective. Was like, no, like, this is something I know and I think it's great. So you should think it's great too. I'm not going to ask you a single question. I'm just going to tell you my great experience as a first grader. And I don't remember her saying anything in response. Years later, I learned she went to a Methodist church in town. And probably at that time, I was probably like, ooh, do they even like know God over there? Like, this was sort of the space growing up. It was like the Southern Baptist churches that I went to when I was younger was like, we know what's up, and other people are okay, but they might not know as much as we do. That was sort of the culture of it in my particular places where I was.
Was there like a distinction for you between your relationship with Jesus versus your relationship with God? Like, you know what I mean? Did you note that? And what did that, I mean, that's been true for me, and I hear a lot of people talking about that. So I'm curious for you, like, what did that mean and look like, that differentiation?
Well, I think when I was younger, I didn't think about God that much. God wasn't really, or the Holy Spirit, mind you. Like, it was like one note, which, not a bad note, right? I mean, not a bad note. But I would say in my, as I've grown, that my image of God has also grown and has been filled in and continues to be. And I would also say in learning more about the way I think about big picture God, it's also informed my experience of Jesus.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think what, especially when you're younger, that idea of like Jesus as sort of the friend, right? He was human. He scraped his knees. He as a child, like that's very tangible versus God. You're like, I don't know. He's with you all the, like, what even is, he's with you all the time. Like it can be very confusing. And so I just hear a lot of kids who grew up in, conservative churches have that sort of like strong tie to Jesus when that other stuff kind of gets confusing and falls away. This idea of friend in Jesus understands me, experienced suffering, still is strong.
Right. And you were even saying about the Holy Spirit. For me, I thought it was like that weird uncle. The Holy Spirit was like someone we didn't really talk about. That was for those other people. And he was sort of that weird uncle in the room. And God was sort of this ethereal, I have no idea, maybe mad or whatever. But yeah, I can totally relate to like Jesus being more of like a friend. We sang that song, What a Friend We Have in Jesus, all of that. So it and probably for kids, it makes a lot of sense. You were saying that you feel like it's been the most consistent thing. So where you are today, would you use that same phrase, or would there be a different phrase where you are today in your spiritual journey?
I wouldn't not say that phrase. I don't know if it would be the first thing. But I do think, I have been in the last several years, our family has been attending a Quaker meeting, and the Quakers are
Cool.
known as the Religious Society of Friends. And
Oh.
so I would say that while that is a different expression, still a Christian expression, of course, as far as the way the Quaker community lives out their faith, it looks very different than the way I grew up, and all the way from, the Southern Baptist churches I grew up in to the, as years went by, we attended like a evangelical, non-denominational, eventually Presbyterian, faith spaces. Those look particular ways. And I've brought gifts along the way from those spaces. But I would say since we've been attending a Quaker meeting and our Quaker community, there are familiarities. There are things that ring true, that sing well in harmony with my own faith background and my own experience of God. But the table just feels wider. It feels wider now. And I would say the way that my Quaker friends honor and are able to make peace with silence and experiencing God in silence has been so deeply transformative for me. This agendaless space of listening and waiting worship is what they call it, has been a real gift for me just as a person. And also as someone who has always identified with Jesus as friend, but now that has just expanded to just kind of a wider, longer table.
I love that. I've been to a Quaker meeting before. My brother was a part of, I don't know how much he was a part of it, but he went to a Quaker meeting house like occasionally at one point in his life. So I went one time and I was so uncomfortable with how quiet it was. I remember that. I was like, why is there not someone standing up just talking all the time? And it was like different voices, everybody's voice like mattered. Like you didn't have to have, it wasn't the person with like the highest degree who had the most knowledge who was talking to everyone else. It was like everyone was involved. And so it was really cool, but I am so bad with silence. And I think that was my first experience of like, of really realizing, wow, I have so much trouble actually sitting and absorbing the Holy Spirit. I'm too busy moving around and talking. And so that's so interesting that you bring that up. That so when you go to a meeting, what did you say? You said something about, what did you call it? The silence.
The waiting worship.
The waiting worship. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about like what that looks like?
Yeah, I'd love to. Well, I'll back up a little bit and just say that when you say the word Quaker, there's probably a lot of images that come to mind. I mean, probably the first one is the Quaker Oats guy. Like, let's just be real. It's fine. It's not offensive. And I think there's a lot of, narratives that we have around these different faith traditions, these different expressions, different ways of expressing love for God. And we all have them, and it's totally fine. It's neutral. And I have them too. And I would say that, a couple of years ago when John and I first attended this particular Quaker meeting, and by the way, when we say meeting, that's just the Quaker way of saying church. Like, that's the word they use. But there's a broad spectrum of what we mean. It's sort of like saying Christian church. It's like, okay, well, what do you mean by that? Like, there's a lot of different kinds. And same goes for Quaker. Some Quaker people who would say, oh, I'm a practicing Quaker or I'm Quaker. Some of those people might not even believe in God, honestly. They might go to meet. It's more of a like they sort of circle themselves around like matters of justice and the Quaker tenets of peace and of equality and of there are tenets of Quakerism that kind of are shared by all. And then there's the other end of the spectrum where someone might say, well, I go to a Quaker meeting, and there you walk into their meeting and it looks just like your evangelical non-denominational church down the road. There's worship time, there's a pastor,
Oh, wow.
there's maybe like a some silence, but maybe not very much. You kind of have to dig down, like, okay, and ask the second and third question when we're talking about it. So I would say the meeting that we attend is not just probably the one that you are talking about,
yeah.
Elizabeth, was where it was more of a what they call a non-programmed meeting, okay. where you kind of go in and you sit in a yeah. circle and you hold silence. And that's all, yeah. that's what it is.
Okay.
And sometimes people will share as they are moved to share. And then other times nobody will, and there'll just be a whole bunch of silence. And then there's the other end where it's fully programmed services, much like the one I just described,
right.
that looks like a non-denominational evangelical space. We go to sort of like a semi-programmed. So it's an hour long. We do have a pastor, and she gives about a 10-minute message about halfway through the time. And there is some singing. But then after her message, this is what I love about it. Again, she'll maybe speak 10 to 12 minutes. And then sometimes she'll pose a question at the end to think about during the waiting worship, the time of silence. Mm. And then you sit and you just sit in silence. And there's something really powerful for me about sitting in a room with other people who are unintimidated by a silent room. Mm. I can get a great sermon online. I cannot get communal silence online.
Mm.
And so sitting in a room embodied with others who are facing the same direction and are listening for God in the space, even if it's just in their own heart, and then hoping that none of us are perfectly doing this, but I think there is an intention of wanting to listen and respond to what was brought in the message, and to then consider it in our own hearts. Mm-hmm. And if there's something to share with the meeting, either that we read earlier that day or that we thought of during the message, then we can share that with the meeting. But it's something I've observed after several years of being part of this meeting is, y'all, the Quakers are not long-winded. They like say what they need to say and they sit down.
Hmm.
Like there's no like, and I'm going to now sit up and share my testimony for 15 minutes. No,
right.
That's not happening. Now, maybe in some spaces it does, but in ours it doesn't. And y'all listen, control will always find a way. I found myself in these times of silence, like starting to measure the silence, like, okay, we started the silence at 11:30. All right. And now how long is it going to be before someone says something? I'm like, it's 11:35. It's 11:38. It's 11:42. And no one said anything. And I'm writing in my journal. And then I would notice when someone would speak and I would time that, y'all, this is so embarrassing. I would time that and be like, they spoke for 45 seconds exactly. And the next person, they spoke for 1 minute and 2 seconds exactly. Like these people are succinct.
They are.
And I noticed that as a pattern. But over time, I feel like Spirit was kind of like, hey, girl, measuring is not listening. So you can just calm all the way down and just be here with these people. And you never have to say a word. You just get to share this space and allow silence to do what silence does and kind of take root and quiet down and hush what needs hushing. And I have found that to be such a gift for me at the end of my week or the beginning of my week, depending on how you see Sundays. And so that's kind of how it looks for us. And then once there's about 20, 25 minutes of shared silence, or sometimes some people will share, one or two people, sometimes, if we're lucky, someone will break out in song. And that's been really special for me.
Wow.
Honestly, I love that when that happens. It doesn't happen very often. And then at the end, someone will stand up and say, ask the question, are all hearts and minds clear? And has silence for another 5 seconds or so. And then there's a benediction and we're done.
Wow.
And that just simple order of worship for me now has been transformative and kind. Now, I will also tell you, full confession, that there is something about liturgy that I deeply miss, that the Quaker tradition, part of what they do is they believe that all of the sacraments are internal. And so, you know, the sacrament of they're not giving the Eucharist or the Lord's Supper, because that's something we take part in every day when we eat together with one another. Like this is an internal experience of something that's true. But y'all, I miss some of the outward liturgies that were a part of my Presbyterian days when we were at a Presbyterian church. So if there was a such thing as like an Episcopal Quaker, maybe that's where I would be.
But that's cool.
As far as I know, there's not.
That's really cool.
Right. As you were talking about the whole silence thing, I'm in training to be a spiritual director, and I know you're a spiritual director. And I think that is like almost exact, that holy listening is like 99% of what I'm learning I need to be for others.
Yeah.
Right? Where you're just in that posture of silence and listening. And somebody actually said in our training that somebody who's already a spiritual director said that when you go into a spiritual direction practice, sometimes people just sit there and want silence for an hour. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, I don't know if I'm going to be okay with that.
Right.
I'm a talker and I'm a solver. And so it's been, like you said, a practice, which we're not comfortable in America with silence. Let's just face it. We're not comfortable. We're comfortable with noise and busyness and our anxiety and looping and all of that. And so there is that long, slow, measured practice, which takes time. My husband started out, I remember, with a set 5-minute quiet sit. Now that guy can do it in the airport for 25 minutes. And I'm like, what? And I'm still at
very
like
Quaker of him.
He is very Quaker. He's very, I mean, we have this way of council stuff going on in our little groups that meet in our house. We've got Parker Palmer going on.
Yes, let's go.
Everybody calls him like a mystic. He's very, very cute. So he'll probably listen to this podcast and be like, Esther, can we go to the Quaker meeting that's just down the road? It might be a good fit.
We'll be right back to the rest of today's podcast episode. But first, we want to give a shout out to some of our amazing and faithful Patreon supporters, Rachel Schoon, Melanie Bishop, and Jennifer Winner. For just $3 a month, you can help us keep the lights on and at the same time, be part of our safe and private Patreon community, where you won't feel so alone in this ever-evolving faith and parenting journey. We hope to see you there. Now, back to the episode.
We start off every podcast episode with a quote. And on our very second episode where I told my story, Liz told her story first, and then I told my story. We used this quote from you, which is my favorite quote probably in the whole wide world, because it's the uppermost question in my mind when making decisions. And actually, as you always say on your podcast, making a life. And especially when it comes to my personal spiritual journey. And here's the question. Am I being pushed by fear or led by love? I know what it's meant to me, and I talk about it ad nauseum here on the podcast and everywhere in all my writing. But what does that question mean to you, and how has that question impacted maybe your spiritual journey?
Fear is a powerful motivator, and it can get us to do or not do a lot of things. And it's done that in my life. But when I started asking myself that question, I don't think it changed my life immediately, but over time, asking myself that question, especially when I was faced with a big decision that was giving me trouble, that question can be a real clarifier, because I think we all know what fear feels like in our own bodies, and we also know what love feels like. And so for me, that's been a question that I've carried for many, many years. And when I ask it, it offers clarity. It doesn't always give me the courage to act, but at least I think it can be an arrow to know if I'm heading in a direction that's aligned with what I most value and who I most deeply am.
Can you tell us maybe one instance where that maybe comes to your mind immediately, where you were maybe being pushed by fear and you ended up being led by love instead?
Sure. I think as we were discerning whether or not to stay at our church that we loved, where we had our closest friends, where we had our deep, deeply loved community, where we had given time and attention, a place that we had helped to build. We didn't start the church, but we helped build it. Or if we were to reconsider and re-examine some of the systems and structures that that church was built upon and continued to perpetuate. And if that meant that we were to try to hang around and try to, as they say, make an impact from the inside, or if it was time for us to part ways and to move on. And we stayed there. You know, it's hard to, you know, in hindsight, you can say like, we should have left sooner. I don't know if that's true. I think you do what you can and you do what you know when you know it. But I definitely think there were times when talking with John on walks at our kitchen table over dinner, when we went out to eat, like, you know how it is, those decisions that you're carrying for a really long time. I'm talking years carrying this decision of like, there's so much about this that's good. There's so much about this that we love. But then there's this other part over here, some of the theology and some of the practice and some of the way the leadership works. And just over time, it started to get heavier on that side. But I could feel myself, I could feel the push and pull of fear and love in all of those conversations. Because it's like Fear says, you know what you're leaving. You don't know what's on the other side of that door. And what if it's nothing? What if it's loneliness? It will be, and it was. What if it's rejection? What if it feels like a whole lot of loss? What if it's a free fall? And so fear kept me in the room probably longer than maybe I was comfortable staying in, but eventually love led me right out. And that's not a verdict on the people who are still there or who chose differently. I think that's the beauty of life with God, is that it's our life with God. And God is like, you know, strong enough and intuitive enough and loving enough to lead you in your own way and in your own time. And I trust God with that. Mm-hmm. But for us, I think that is probably maybe one of the most recent and the most powerful and painful experiences of being pushed by fear, led by love.
Mm. Yeah. I think everybody listening right now is thinking, me too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know Liz and I are saying me too. Because of that long, slow journey of, like you said, the back and forth, what do I do? How do I make this decision in a way that is the most loving for me, for my kids, for those I'm leaving, for those maybe I don't know yet? And you alluded right there to your book, where you said walking out of that room. And your book is called How to Walk Into a Room, which I'm so excited about. When this airs, it will be on shelves everywhere. And the opening section, though, before walking into a room is on leaving, how to walk out of a room. What are some of the reasons that you found or we find that we walk out of rooms? And maybe what was the most difficult part of, like you said, walking out of that room of that particular faith community?
Well, I think there are lots of reasons why we might discern to walk out of a room. And a lot of those reasons other people won't ever understand, or they will understand them and they'll just disagree with them. And that can also keep us in a room for longer than maybe we feel comfortable. But I think when it comes to the rooms of our lives, various rooms, whether it's a faith community, a job, a relationship, an ideology, that there are those rooms where we feel quite comfortable. There are rooms that we walk into for a second and we're like, not my room. I'm leaving here. You know, we know it immediately. Like, you can feel it. And then there are those rooms more that we're talking about now, where we've been in it for a while. Maybe we prayed for this space. Maybe we paid to get in this space. Maybe it was a college, or we were picked for this space. I mean, there's a lot of reasons, that things that bring us into rooms that are really great things that we celebrate. But then something begins to shift, either in us or in the room or in the people who are there too. And we start to question. And I think some of us shut it down right then. We shut it down. We're like, nope. Too much at stake. And, you know, I have a lot of compassion for that, because I think that's not the end of the story, but that is a lot of part of our stories, is that first, like, nope, not going to do that. But if you do grow uncomfortable enough to have to ask those questions, I think it begins with slowly turning on the lights of the room and being really honest about what you see without judgment for you being there still, or as much as we can, reserving judgment for the people who are loving the room, who don't see what you see. That's hard to do. But I think being able to name, like, what's good and beautiful here? Because there are good and beautiful things. Did I choose this room, or did it choose me? And are the circumstances at play still happening when I chose this room, or have things changed? And if so, what? Are there things about this room that I've been avoiding for a really long time? And we all know what those are. We don't say them out loud. We might not put them in our journal, but they linger in the back of our mind. Like, yeah, that's a thing I know is true that I don't like to admit, that none of us talk about. It's like, we all have an agreed contract. That's one of the scripts of the room, is we don't talk about the fact that whatever it is in your space, like, you know, for us at our particular place, we don't really talk about the fact that women aren't in the room where decisions are made. We don't really talk about that. We just know that it's, you know, all the men are elders, and that's what they've agreed, and that's the theology they think is true. And I'm uncomfortable with it, and a lot of people were uncomfortable with it, but that's just how it was. But you turn on the lights and you see, like, this is interesting. This ship is headed in a direction that I think, had there been both men and women, male and female, full image of God in the room, maybe some things could have been avoided. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Call me crazy. But these are the type of things that we start to notice as we turn on the lights. Again, it doesn't mean you see something you don't like, head out the door. But it does mean, let's be honest about what's happening here so that we can make an informed decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the avoiding it is so easy. because there's so much at stake for whatever room you're in, a family, a church, a job.
A job,
I mean,
yeah.
Lots of different spaces where you're like, I'm just going to hush that. You be quiet over there, mind. And I like something you always say is just like to pay attention, to notice, you know, what is that little thing that keeps niggling at you saying to you? What is it trying to say? And then maybe it gets so uncomfortable for us that we have to make a decision that is going to probably give us a lot of grief and heartache and pain and frustration. So,
yeah, there's a piece of it where, like you were saying, Emily, how you're not always ready, right, at a certain time. Maybe you'll be ready later on. And I think there's something really beautiful in that and being able to know, like, when it's really your time to, when you're really ready emotionally. And, you know, I think for many years we stayed in our church community because I was a young mom and I needed that community.
Yes, that's right.
And so we hung in, right? Yep. We hung in there because that was what was needed, even though there was all of these things where I was like, this is not me. This is not authentic. This doesn't feel right for me. But the survival mode of being a mom with postpartum anxiety was way more important at that time, right? So I think that we all make these decisions at different times in our life, like based on our own needs, which I think is so very cool. And being able to, you know, can we have grace for the differing journeys? And that is hard. It is hard not to judge someone who's judging you, right, for being far, you know, on the outskirts or whatever. Yeah. It can be really tricky, but I think that's just an important thing that we probably could all work on.
Right.
It's just having grace for other people's journeys if they look different.
And for your own, because I think it can be so easy to carry shame that, like, I have these young children and I desperately need this community. And for us to leave now would cause more harm than the harm is being caused by us staying. And I have so much compassion for that. And I think the hardest person to have compassion for is myself when I look back and think, like, why didn't we leave sooner? It's like, you know what? You weren't ready and that's okay.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
I was just even thinking, Liz, last summer and sending your kids to vacation Bible school and you don't go to church. And I was like, oh, good for you. You get like a morning off like for a week in the summer, but you don't necessarily align with every single belief system. But what was more important to you at the time is that your kids go and have a cute week and you have some time to yourself to recover. And those are the complicated, nuanced things that all of our journeys of faith, we want to allow for that. We don't want to be, I mean, you and I talk about this all the time on our podcast and with you, Emily, you talk about this. We don't want to be rigid and we don't want to be ruled by shame and guilt and fear. We want to be ruled by compassion and curiosity and love. And the biggest space we need to do that for is ourselves. Even when we don't feel super integrated, it's like, I just said on my podcast, my kids aren't going to BBS. And guess what? I just signed my kids up for BBS.
Well, yeah, I think it's like, as we're talking about parenting, it's being able to do that with our kids too, right? Like have curiosity and offer them experiences, but then be able to be like a safe place. Like if Lila would come home and say, Mommy, we learned about this guy who had nails in his hands. I mean, she knows who Jesus is, but she doesn't know the crucifixion story, you know, and she would come back and talk to me, that I would be a safe place that she knew that she could talk to me and we could talk through it and we could be curious together about, you know, oh, well, what did they say? And like, what does that sound like for you? And being able to have some more of those like open conversations and right, not being so rigid and saying like, oh, well, we're never going to do this or we're never going to do that. But just being able to trust the process and trust our story and trust ourselves in each moment, right, based on what we feel that, you know, where God might be leading, if that's something that people still feel. I know some, you know, not everyone feels God's leading, but if you feel leading you that way, or even if you just feel like your own intuition, right, is leading, which I believe is the Holy Spirit, but that's a separate story. But whatever it is, right, just being able to trust that and to move into that
right,
without shame, like you said, Emily.
Well, your second section of your book talks about that pause between walking out of a room and walking into a room. And I love your idea, and you said it just a little bit, and you've said it along, and I'm always looking for arrows because of your words to me. Following those arrows, can you describe what an arrow is? And everybody just needs to read the book, The Next Right Thing. You'll know all about what an arrow is in depth. So, and probably you talk about it more in your new book. But just tell us, give us a little glimpse into what an arrow is and how one might gently guide us to do the next right thing in love, as you say on your podcast. Why is that pause so important?
I think the easiest way that I found to describe the arrows, and by the way, if you read the next right thing, you might not understand arrows because I still have people 5 years later like, but what do you mean by arrows? I read the book. I've listened to the podcast for 6 years. I don't know what you mean. And I'm like, okay, I have not done a good job. This is on me. This is not on you, listener, reader. This is on me. So I do have a whole nother chapter in this next book about arrows and answers because I wanted to go further into it. And really, I think an arrow is in its most, I think this is what discernment is. I think discernment is a process of following arrows. And the easiest picture that I have found to be able to describe it for people, and the one that I think people are like, oh, that makes sense, is if you're going on a trip, a road trip, and you want to head to Florida. I live in North Carolina. So when I leave Greensboro, North Carolina, and get on the highway, I don't see a road sign that says, this way to Florida, this many miles to Florida. Like, we don't care. It's too far away. But we do see a sign. We might see a sign outside of my town that says, you know, it's 79 miles to Charlotte. And so we go to Charlotte. And then in Charlotte, you're going to find your way to Columbia. And then Columbia, and you go you're following the arrows along the way. You're headed in the direction of Florida, but your signs aren't going to say Florida this way. And I think the same goes for a lot of our decisions, especially the bigger ones, the ones that give us the most trouble, is that rarely, maybe sometimes, but rarely do we have the question like, should I leave my church? Should I quit my job? Should I marry this person? And then we have a next day, yes, no, like that's not our life. We all know that. And so I'm just putting language on the experience that we are already having. That's what I kind of see my job as, is like, let me give language for that thing we're all doing. And that is that we are following a series of arrows. And so that's why for me, the next right thing, with the emphasis being on next, maybe more than right, but the next right thing really is, what is my next thing just right now? And what do I know now? Because there's a lot I don't know. But maybe there's a few things I do know, even if it's just one thing. And y'all, sometimes that one thing is, I don't know what to do about this situation in my faith community or in my marriage or in this friend group, but I do know that I need to take a shower.
Yes.
So that's what I'm going to do right now. And I take a shower. And then after my shower, there's going to be another next thing to do. And eventually you'll follow the arrows. You're going to, as we kind of open ourselves up to discernment, as we open ourselves up to God, to our own intuition, to all those things, we're going to know what to do when we need to know it. And probably not a second sooner.
Yeah. That's so good. Oh my goodness.
I think there's so much emphasis, I think, or there was for me growing up in an evangelical community, on thinking ahead.
Yeah.
Like, there was so much emphasis for me on thinking ahead, right? You're thinking about eternity, you're thinking about purity, you're thinking about, you know, you're thinking about all of these things, right? And you're thinking farther than the moment in front of you. Mm. And it can be very overwhelming. And so I love what you're talking about, even just in everyday life, right? Like, not even a faith thing, like, yeah, the day that you wake up depressed, right? Or anxious, yes, you don't even want to go out of bed. The first thing to do is just swing those legs over the side.
Yep.
Right? Like, I mean, there's moments when that's all we can do. And I feel like that's just such a beautiful picture of what I really think that God wants for our life. Is like, hey, just focus on the right now and the next thing and all that extra, like, you said, all that extra stuff. I think it was Corrie Ten Boom, or her dad, I think, that said, when it's time to get on the train, then you'll get your ticket.
Right.
Like, I'm butchering the quote. Really beautiful quote, but I'm butchering it.
But I like it. I like your
but it's
way.
The same idea, right? Yeah. Right. Like that, like, as when it's time to get on the train, I will hand you your ticket. So it doesn't get lost on the way.
Yeah.
You'll just get it when you need it.
Yeah.
And that takes, I think, some of the pressure off, like you said, of like making those big decisions or feeling like you need to know what to do in every moment, what school to send your kid in 3 years, what da 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 da. It's just like, no, just right now.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm getting passionate because I just think it's so, we just blow through to what's next, and we cause ourselves so much confusion and exhaustion and shame because of that.
Right. And as you were talking, Liz, you just even said the purity culture, I'm thinking like, we're always like thinking about our wedding night, what decisions about our wedding night, instead of like, well, right now in this moment with this boy, when I'm in high school, am I respecting myself? Am I feeling like really good in my body about what's happening? And it's all about like the future, the future, the future, right, instead of what's actually happening in the moment. So, I mean, it's just, I was like, whoa, I've done that forever. So, right. Well, the last thing you say in your book, or the last section of your book, is actually the title of your book, How to Walk Intro Room, right? And my favorite thing that you say is we need to walk into a room, whatever it is, as a beginner, the first time we take one teeny step, when we're squeaking the door open to our next thing, a leader, a listener, and your own friend, to go back to the friend thing. Why does it matter so much when we're thinking about all of our faith decisions, our spiritual decisions, what we talk here, our parenting decisions, that we take our friendship with ourselves seriously when we're in the shifting spaces? And can you tell us maybe a story about the way you have been a friend during your kind of, like you said, widening faith journey? I love that word, that the table has gotten longer and wider. How have you been a good friend to yourself?
Well, one thing I know for sure about all of us, 100% of the time, is that every room that I walk into for the rest of my life, there's one person who goes with me, and it's me. And so I can't escape from myself. And I think some of us spend our whole lives running from ourselves. And that can be a really painful, disorienting, divided journey. And you mentioned Parker Palmer earlier. I don't want to live a divided life. I want to live an undivided life. And so that's why friendship with yourself is so deeply important. And it's something that I'm learning, that I'm imperfect at. I'm probably the harshest critic of my own self. I think we probably would all agree in some ways that's true for all of us. And so I'm learning to honor my own voice at the table as I would honor a friend's voice, not to the exclusion of everyone else's, but just that I would honor my own voice too.
Yeah.
I'm learning how to walk into a room extending myself grace and compassion in the way that I talk about extending grace and compassion to other people, not to the exclusion of everyone else, but that I would do it for myself too. And I think I'm also learning what it means to walk into a room. I think to be a friend to yourself is one way of leading yourself first, that learning to be a leader in a room, even if you're not in the one in charge, it doesn't matter who's in charge, but being a leader in the room is learning to lead myself. And part of doing that is being my own friend. I can think of a time, maybe it was a year or so after we left our church, and we were kind of visiting others and sometimes not. Like, we sort of, for a minute, thought like, maybe we're not church people. Maybe we're just people. And we belong to God and we belong to each other. And I don't know what that looks like faith community-wise. But we discovered over time that and I'm glad we kind of had that little time away, because it kind of grew in us like, no, this is something we want. We want a faith community. Mm-hmm. We don't know how it's going to look. We don't know how involved we'll be right away, or maybe ever. I don't know, y'all. But we did start visiting around and trying some things out in different communities out slowly. But it was during that time that my friend Melissa, one of my dear friends from college, she and I kind of, when we got married, we were in a small group together in an evangelical church, and we've kind of grown together in our faith in different ways. She's now part of an Anglican church and was being ordained as a deacon in the Anglican church. And she invited me to come to her ordination service in Anglican church, where we don't attend, but, you know, I was fine to go visit. And so I went that night. I went alone. John couldn't go. And I walked into this sanctuary that I'd never been before with some familiar people, because, I mean, I've lived here for 20 years, so I know a lot of people in town. There's only a few churches people go to. So it's like, yep, I see you. Hey, there you go. Great people, wonderful people, and a really lovely community. And so her service happened. It was lovely. It was meaningful. Afterwards, I joined up with her family, and I hugged her, congratulated her. And so many people there. I mean, it was really interesting and moving for me to watch how many people were supporting her in this process that she had been in for a while, how many friends they had developed there in this space, and how many cards and gifts and hugs that she got. But I was, you know, and I don't say this like feel sorry for me. I'm just saying, in fact, I was an outsider there. Like, this was not my faith community. I didn't know a lot of the people. I knew some of them. So I really kind of got to be, I was not a fly on the wall, but I sort of felt like one. And when I left that night, I remember went back to my car. I sat in the dark in my driver's seat of my car and in the silence. And again, silence does a thing, right? I'm learning this. And in the silence, I just tried to get honest as my own friend about, like, how am I feeling right now? Because I was thrilled for my friend and her ordination, something she worked so hard for. I was moved by her community. I also had a profound sense of loneliness because I wasn't a part of that community. I also felt a sense of loss because there was a time when, you know, my husband was a pastor for 12 years, a youth pastor. We were part of a large church community in town. We were known by a lot of people. John pastored so many kids in our community through high school. And when our kids hit high school, we don't have a youth group. We don't have a community. My husband spent so much time pouring into the lives of these families and children that we see on a weekly basis around town because they're everywhere. Who's going to pour into my kids? Mm-hmm. And so I watched her kind of have the thing that I always thought I would have by the time we were this age and doing this work and with these kids at this age that they are. And I had to pay really close attention, like, do I feel envy? Do I feel, you know, am I bereft? Am I wanting to cry my eyes out? And I did cry a little bit. But I, in those moments, when I got really honest, I recognized like her journey is separate from mine. It doesn't have to say anything about mine. In other words, I was so happy for her that she had set down roots in a place and she was known by a place and by a people. And that was a really beautiful thing. That was a choice that she made. We had made different choices. And because of those different choices, we have a different, life looks different for us now. It's quieter. Our community is a little bit different. We still have beautiful, wonderful friends. But that life of being celebrated by a church community of people who you've known for 15 years, that's just not our life now. And there's grief in that. But I think being my own friend is naming the grief, but not letting it shame me into think we made a wrong choice. Mm. It's just like, sometimes you're lonely, not because you did it wrong, but because you did it.
So good. Well, your kids, like you said, you have your older kids who one's still in high school and twins in college. What do you think has been the hardest part about walking in and out of all those spiritual rooms while in the throes of raising them? And then maybe what's been your best gift? Because a lot of our listeners are walking in and out of rooms, spiritual rooms, while trying to raise their kids. And you did, and you've already kind of been there and done that. And you're still doing it, I would imagine, at some level. Just even ideologies are changing and, you know, growing and shifting. So what's been the hardest part? What's been your biggest gift?
I think the hardest part has been some of what I just mentioned, which was reconciling the fact that we poured into the lives of so many families for so many years. And then when it was our turn to go through those rocky teenage years, there were precious few who were pouring into us. Mm-hmm. And that's still a grief that I carry, honestly. Mm-hmm. But I think on the other side of that, you know, we're still in it in some ways. We have a junior in high school and our twins are in college. But I think the other side of that and the gift that I'm still unwrapping and unpacking is that in my own faith experience, God has not forgotten us and God has not forgotten them. And we see that weekly in conversation with them. We see the ways that though community looks different than we thought, community is not absent. Mm-hmm. We are not alone, though we do feel some loneliness sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a gift I did not know to expect. This is the, when you leave one room, you don't walk into nothing. Something new is always waiting. This is the new that I didn't know to look for and I couldn't have predicted. Mm-hmm. But that longer, wider table that I believe exists in the kingdom of God continues to grow through watching my kids and allowing them to ask their really hard questions and not letting it freak me out. Mm. And I think like, oh, we are the ones who are shepherding our kids now. Like it might not be the community we thought it would be, but now because we had the courage to change our minds, honestly, on some things, we now have access to the hearts of our kids and their faith journey in ways that we never could have. Mm. Had we stayed where we were. And that's a gift I didn't know to ask for.
That's so beautiful. And I think so encouraging for younger moms like myself, right, who have left faith communities because we felt like we needed to and have wondered, like, what have we done?
Right.
Right. In some ways, because I we've been trained maybe in some ways, right, to believe that that's where community is and that that's where healthy faith conversations happen and that's where spiritual growth happens. And so then to leave that and have to kind of stumble along and find that for yourself is really scary.
Yeah.
And can be really terrifying. And a couple weeks ago, I had said to my husband, we have some friends that we're just meeting through my oldest is in kindergarten. So we're meeting friends right through school. And there was a time when I would have been like, oh my gosh, like we can't be close to people who aren't in the church, right? And these people, their daughter has been such a sweet, dear friend to my daughter. And it actually brings tears to my eyes the way that that mom has showed up for me. And there's not a faith connect. That's not a faith connection. That's a relationship just based on humans helping humans and just like just deep love and just it's beautiful, right? But I wouldn't have known that. I wouldn't have known that existed, kind of like what you said. It's like until you step out of sort of like what you knew, you don't even realize that on the other side, there's just like all of these wonderful, beautiful, amazing things that are happening and opportunities to just really like meet people in humanity, which I ultimately think is like what Jesus did his entire life.
Yeah.
Right. And we were like thought, you know, and we like missed it. And then we step back and we're like, oh, here it is.
Right.
Right. Here it is.
Yeah, we always joke that like everybody was just trying to scare me to death that I was going to go on some slippery slope that led to destruction.
Oh, the slippery slope.
Yeah, the slippery slope. And Liz and I call it, another person we had on the podcast, the water slide that leads to life. Like, and you know what? You like go on the water slide, you jump off, and then maybe you go down into the depths of the ocean where there's all this beauty that you never knew was there if you didn't like take a step, start climbing the stairs of the water slide. It's just, so yeah, we joke about that. We're like, we love the water slide that leads to life, but a water slide can be very scary.
Yeah, terrifying.
But I found that too. My kids are older and I found my relationships with them absolutely almost turned on a dime when I started to say, what if I'm wrong? Mm-hmm. And what if they're right? Mm-hmm. And they could be my teachers as much as I can be theirs. I'm just as much of a learner as they are a learner. And we're in this figuring out God together, side by side, instead of I know what's right and you don't. And it literally transformed my entire relationship with my kids. And so I'm like, there's a lot of hope. My daughter is really good friends with Liz. They have little kids together. And I just think like, wow, how exciting is that we're all getting to do this wrestling together about God, which is
really beautiful. The wrestling with another person, like, you know, or not. I just got this visual of like being like 6 years old wrestling with my brother. But, you know, like the wrestling with our faith journeys and our spiritual journeys, like with another person is so much more beautiful than just like sitting next to someone in a pew and just like kind of like linking arms and just agreeing on all the same things, you know, like that it's not as beautiful as like the back and forth and the ups and downs and just being able to be honest with where you are and how you feel and know you're not being judged. And it can be really cool.
Well, you have watched your kids go in and out of lots of rooms and you're going to have one room that closes, right? The door closes in a year or so. And your son is going to be walking into his next room. But our tagline is grace for who we have been and space for who we are becoming. Well, grace for who we have been and are now and space for who we are becoming. And so how do you think that you've provided a place or ways that we can provide a place of grace for our kids, who they have been, who they are now, who they're becoming as they kind of transition and walk in and out of those rooms in their life?
Well, you said it. I think for me in my own experience, it's first doing that for myself. Mm-hmm. Because man, they pick up on how we treat ourselves more than they pick up anything I would ever say. Mm. And I've watched my kids, like I'll see them sometimes say things or do things. And I'm like, you learned that from me. That's terrible. This is terrible. What's happening? And like, I'll think like, I never taught you that. I never even said that out loud. And yet here you are doing the thing or believing the narrative that I have somehow passed on to you about whatever yourself or your self-image or your image of God or whatever. So I think that that would be my first and maybe only word of wisdom when it comes to parenting is be a friend to yourself, is be loved and be the loved, is know how deeply and profoundly accepted you are and to relentlessly be kind to yourself. And I think that my kids, in moments when I've been able to do that, honestly, that seems to be like the thing that gets through to them the most. And because when I'm doing that, then I'm not holding myself to this impossible, like human or parenting standard. And then I'm not freaking out when they do something so dumb that I'm like, because so many times when our kids do stuff that we would never have done, that we taught them differently, all those things, all it does, it's actually not a big deal in the scheme of things. But what we think it does is it like says something terrible about me. And I think if I practice kindness toward myself, then I can, that's my foundation before this judgment of like my kid's behavior somehow indicting me to be like a terrible parent.
Right. It's so interesting how we like so quickly jump to this idea that if we take care of ourselves, right, like we're going to be letting our kids down or like neglecting our kids in some way. Right. I think it's just so, it's so interesting that you said that, and so cool that you keep coming back to this idea of like being a friend to yourself and how that's important, like all these different areas of our life. And just the other day, usually when my husband gets home from work, he works long hours. I'm home with my kids. I'm doing this. I'm doing a million things, right? And I take like an hour to myself almost every day when he comes home. And the other day he came home and my four-year-old said like, oh, mommy, can you do this with me? And my six-year-old was like, nope, mommy has her break now. And I would have been horrified that she said that maybe even just like a year ago. I would have been like, oh my gosh, my break. Does she think I need a break? But it was just like, matter of fact, like mommy takes a break. And so even in those little moments where it doesn't feel like it really matters, right? Or doesn't feel like it's really making a difference, they are watching and they do see. And we can feel no shame and freedom, right, to just be a friend to ourselves and know that that matters. And now you with older kids are saying, hey, listen, I've been doing this. I've seen it play out
both ways.
And it matters and it's important and it makes a difference.
Well, I just keep thinking about Lila when she's 16 going like, I'm having my hour break now and you're going to cheer her on.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so.
Wouldn't that be something? Wouldn't that be something?
I hope she gets home from school.
And you're going to cheer her on.
Yep. And says, it was a long day.
Yeah.
I'm taking my hour break. And I will say, you go, girl. I'm also taking my hour break.
That's so cute.
Yeah.
Well, Emily, we're going to end with this. If you were sitting at a table with your three kids and you knew for sure, this is my favorite part, that they would take your message with them on their life's journey, what would you want them to know about God, faith, and themselves?
I think I would, if I knew for sure that they would take it and believe it, I think I would want them to for sure know how loved they are by God. Mm-hmm. I think I would want them to know that God is on their side. And I think I would also hope that I could, if I could impart to them to pay attention to what their parents say forever and know that they would take it. Like, we've lived life. We know some things. No, that's kind of a joke. But I think maybe the final thing would just be that they would know that ultimately, though everything may not be okay, that deep down, really, they're going to be okay. And I think that's true.
Mm. Yeah, that's powerful.
Oh, good. All right, Emily, after your book launches, which is when we're taping this in 5 days, but as we said at the beginning, everywhere of our books are sold today, what do you think your next right thing is in love?
Well, thank you for the question. And I will say my next right thing, in all honesty, after I have the privilege of talking about this book, and I hope to talk about the message of this book. I mean, that's why we write books, right? It's not just for when it launches. It's like, and now we get to talk about it. And this is a conversation that we can have for years and years to come. And I'm so thrilled with it. But in the interim, between now and forever, I do look forward to taking some time off this summer. You know, I have a podcast called The Next Right Thing, and I have not really taken significant time off in 6.5 years, almost 7 years, but I intentionally don't have ads on the podcast, not because I'm against them, but because I want the freedom. Like, I'm way too autonomous to like, I don't want to have things scheduled out for the next, you know, 6 months. And so, but I have not taken a lot of advantage of that. So I'm like, I'm my own boss. So I'm going to take some time off this summer from the podcast. And I look forward to that. But yeah, if you want to find me, you can find me there at the Next Right Thing podcast.com. Also emilypfreeman.com. Don't forget the P. It's important. There's another Emily Freeman out there. We high five on the internet, the other Emily Freemans and I, but we are different. And so Emily P. Freeman on Instagram, on The website is emilypfreeman.com. And then I have a Substack where we kind of take what we start on the podcast on Tuesdays and kind of go beyond the pro con list on Wednesdays at The Soul Minimalist on Substack, where we talk about other ideas of decision making and discernment. But now we get to, instead of just me saying words, I get to communicate and talk with readers and listeners, which is my favorite thing to do. So.
Yeah. It's really great there. And what you're doing is so fabulous. So we really appreciate your time with us today and helping us to walk in and out of rooms.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Deconstructing Mamas podcast. We love that you tuned in and hope that this gave you a little bit of grace and space for your soul to breathe.
Don't forget to catch up on any of our episodes that you missed. And remember to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Deconstructing Mamas.
That's where you'll find all the information that you need about the podcast, as well as on our website, deconstructingmamas.com. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter when you get there.
If you'd like to support the podcast, join our Patreon network for just $3 a month and have access to our private community with all kinds of extras. Leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts or just tell others about the show.
Thanks for listening and come back again for our next episode. We can't wait to be on the other side of your headphones.